Vinayaka Sutta, which we just recited, speaks of smoking by night and flaming by day. And even though the sutta as a whole has this whole series of similes and images, this is like the framing image that seems to kind of bracket the whole sutta or put a context to the sutta as a whole. So smoking or fuming by night and flaming by day became like a classic Buddhist image repeated in the commentaries and various stories and so on, a bit like the image of the monkey, like the monkey mind kind of image. It became such a classic. This one also is perhaps not as well known, but both very commonly used. And so the idea of smoking or fuming you can imagine actually what happens in a lot of forest fires, that when they the fire goes through, the place burns and often it will cool down at the night time and get a bit damp, and the fire will become quite subdued or even go out, and then when the day comes again it will light it up again. Happens sort of quite literally. There's some places where that happens for long periods of time, when the fire gets into like peat and so on under the earth, and it can actually keep on fuming there for long periods of time, and when the heat comes up it'll burst back into flame again. So probably like so many of the Buddhist images, something which was just like a familiar sight to the people the Buddha was speaking to. So the smoking by night is the thinking and planning and proliferating that we keep on doing in private, in our own little theatre, playing things out with imaginary characters. And then the acts that we do in the daytime. Taking those imaginations and fantasies and so on making them real, bringing them to light. So one way of looking at this is that kind of process has both a positive and a negative side. On the positive side, this is how human activity happens. This is where human civilization, human creativity, human culture, everything that we value and think worthwhile about what humanity has done, this is how it comes. It comes from first thinking and pondering and working things out, and then going and doing it. And this is also one of the crucial this involves us in a feedback loop, which is one of the crucial things that actually helps us to mature and to grow up. And this is something which is one of those kind of, I guess, frustrating things about as you get older, and then you sort of look at people who are younger than yourself and think, oh yeah, I know what they're like, and you'll grow out of it. It's the kind of thing that when people told you that when you were young, you got so frustrated and annoyed with them. But of course it's quite true. This is one of the things that tends to happen, is that when we're young, of course, we're very idealistic because we have all these plans and so on, and we haven't yet had so much chance to put them into practice. But when we take those things, those fumings by night, and then actually try to implement them by day, then of course every time we do that, we find that there are compromises to be made, that there are practicalities to bear in mind, that there are pragmatic compromises that we have to work out to get it to happen. And we realize as we do this again and again and again, that this is in the nature of things. This is not just because there's something wrong with the world, or there's something wrong with other people, or something wrong with the material that I'm using. But every time we do something, then it's never the same as what we imagined it to have been. So I come to here and I have this kind of imagination about what the perfect monastery is going to be like. Santi Forest Monastery is going to be the perfect monastery. Of course, I know this is ridiculous, but still, I'm allowed to dream. It's one of the few things that monks are allowed to do. Not encouraged to do it, but you're still allowed. No one can police your mind. Like Bob Dylan said, if my thought dreams could be seen, they'd probably put my head in a guillotine. And so you're allowed to dream, and you're allowed to imagine, wow, this would be a fantastic place, and we'll have, you know, these little kutis in the forest, and we'll make them just right, not too much, not too little, and people will come here, and it'll be very, very secluded, and, you know, all of the problems that I had when I was a young monk, then none of them will have here. So of course we have a whole bunch of other problems instead. And so every time you do anything, you realize there are these compromises. It never works out quite the way that you wanted to. You build a kuti and you realize, well, that there's, you know, the kuti isn't quite facing the direction that you thought it would, or it doesn't quite keep the heat out in the summer as well as you thought it would, or all of these kinds of things. And every time you do everything, it's like that. And you realize it goes right down as far as you want to take it down, not only just building a kuti, but even hammering a nail in. You can't even hammer the perfect nail in. There's always some kind of compromise involved, even when you take it down to that level. And so the reality of what that we're doing by day is constantly feeding back to us. And that, generally speaking, that's a good thing. It makes our thoughts more realistic, makes them more disciplined, but it also sometimes makes them more limited. Sometimes we can give up, or we get more lose the inspiration, lose the dream. So it's important not to do that, but to make the dream more pragmatic, make it realizable. And then when our thoughts are disciplined in this way, then they are more doable. We can actually accomplish the things that we set out to accomplish. So this is one one advantage, like the positive side of the smoking by night and flaming by day. And And of course, the negative side is more what the sutta is implying or implicating. There's an extent to which we kind of need to do things. We need to operate in the world and accomplish things and so on. But then there's an extent to which that becomes like a compulsion, becomes an obsession. And we're not thinking about things by night in a constructive or a useful way, but it just becomes a displacement activity and becomes something that's almost like covering up what we need to be looking at, directing us away from the truth, directing us away from the heart of the matter. And so in this sense it gets very much in a kind of vicious cycle where the proliferations that we have at the night time, for example, maybe we have a particular encounter with a person in the monastery. We come in the daytime and then we have a difference of opinion or exchange some sharp words or something with somebody in the monastery, or maybe someone we just don't get along with. And then we sort of go back and you're kind of sitting meditation, and then that sort of starts to obsess them with the mind, and you start to think about that person and all the things they did wrong and how they're so horrible and nasty and how they're really just stupid and they just don't get it and everything. And of course you forget that this conversation is taking place within your own mind, and that your ability to clearly analyze the situation in a rational way is simply because there's nobody else to refute you except for yourself, and your ability to clearly demonstrate your own moral and spiritual superiority over the other person is also quite understandable given the circumstances. So of course what we're doing when we're thinking like this is we're not actually engaging with that other person, but we're engaging with like a shape in our own mind, a projection from our own mind. So this is very important to remember this, very, very important. The idea that we carry around in our mind of that other person is not the same as that person themselves. The idea that we carry around is what we call sanya or perception or recognition. But what happens, of course, is that we have certain contact with that person, we have a sight, and this is very powerful. We often make very instantaneous judgments about a person based on just the first few seconds that we see them. Something about their expression, the way they hold their body, the way their eyes look, and something like that makes a very vivid impact on our mind, and our mind's programmed to recognize these things very fast. And this comes back to our evolutionary history, where we have to recognize, is this a friend or a foe? And we have to recognize that very quickly. And so our perception is extremely good like that, actually. It works extremely well. The problem is, of course, that it's not always correct, and it's always limited in what it can do, and sometimes is quite misleading. And so we make this idea based on sights of a person, based on all of their sound, what they say, smell, taste, touch, everything about the person becomes a potentially an object of their sensory impact, and it all kind of adds up into this picture. And when we're with that person, then they have a role in that. They can affect that. They can change what they look like, what they sound like, what they say and they do. And so that can kind of feed back into our image. There's some connection there. But when we're not in the presence of that person, when we're away from them, then that stops. So we just have the image like the abstracted version of that person. And so that really is just something we've constructed in our own mind. And it never does justice to the person themselves. So it's always good to reflect like this and to recognize that this is what's going on. There's some kind of inadequate, partial image of a person in our minds. But what's lacking from that image that we carry around is the inner dimension. Because all that we've done is we've derived our idea of that person from external representations, created an idea, and we carry that external representation around. That doesn't have the inner dimension, and it's that inner dimension which feels. It's that inner dimension which suffers. And so when we have that image within our mind, we can be as nasty to it as we like, and nothing suffers. Except, of course, ourselves. But unfortunately, we then tend to take that, the way that we've treated our own image, our own projection, we take that and we then treat the actual person in that way the next time we meet them. And then, of course, they will suffer. So this is one of the problems. And the sutta talks about the like the contrast of the day and the night, the contrast between the thinking and the activities. But that metaphor of the smoking by day, so smoking by night and flaming by day, also has a more kind of pregnant or subtle connotation, which is the night time is the time of the unknown, what is not conscious. So the sutta is talking about the inner in terms of the thoughts and the outer in terms of actions. But we can also think of it in terms of the inner and the outer of the mind itself. Like the inner part of the mind is the unconscious. Those kind of obscure forces, narratives, ideas, memories, symbols, which we generally don't pay much attention to. But they always kind of arise and influence us, and they're always affecting what we think, what we say. And so there's this incessant, almost compulsive need that we feel to avoid looking at what we need to look at. And if you like, Buddhism is constructed out of this. Buddhism as a social or historical phenomenon can be thought of as what Buddhists do to avoid looking at the truth. I remember when Ajahn Sucitto was here, and we were talking. He said, "I was saying, did he lady, I think he'd just been in Thailand, and I said, oh, did you have a nice time in Thailand or something? He said, no, not really. He said, too much Buddhism. And I really kind of understood what he said, you know, because of course everywhere you go there's all these beautiful temples and they're all kind of sparkling and shining and all these Buddha images, thousands and thousands and thousands of Buddha images. So, you know, what's a Buddha image? A Buddha image is an image of a human being sitting down, meditating, looking into the depths of their own consciousness. And it's quite fascinating, really, to see almost the almost chasm of unawareness that Buddhists often have about this. I mean, I don't mean to be unduly critical of Buddhists. I'm just reflecting on us as a group of people. I'm sure the same thing is true of people in general. It's just the power of ignorance, that's all. But Buddhists do go to the temple every day or every once a week or whatever, and they're constantly, they've grown up with this idea. There's this picture of this image of this Buddha sitting in meditation, and the whole thing revolves around worshipping that, moving around that, circling around that, but not actually doing it. And it's almost, you can imagine it like like a hurricane. And there's this endless spiral of activity and movement, which is always moving around and around and around. In the middle of it is nothing. In the middle of it is peace. In the middle of it is a place of stillness. And this is the Buddha. He sits in this place of stillness. There's nothing there. And all this activity which surrounds him, always moving relentlessly, going around and around and around, what is said or what is done, and the books or the texts or the doctrines or the monks or the chanting or the amulets or whatever they are. They're all these kind of spirals which have been like attracted by this spiritual energy from which the Buddha has generated. Which of course is nothing. It's like a black hole. Nibbana is like a black hole. Everything disappears into it. And so everything is coming around. It's actually, the black hole is quite a good simile for Nibbana. You have, like, a black hole has this event horizon where you sort of, as things get closer and closer to the actual black hole, there's a point beyond which light cannot escape, a point beyond which no information can get out. Just before that, there's a lot of energy which is given out. But from the event horizon in, then no energy can escape, no information can escape. That's why it's called the black hole. So nobody knows what goes on in there. Some people say, like Lee Smolin, a great physicist, he suggests that actually on the other side of that black hole is born an entirely new universe. But the truth is, we don't really know what happens there. And so this is very much like Nibbana. We've got no idea really what's happening there. All we know is there's an event horizon beyond which no information comes out. Nobody's sending us any emails from Parinibbana saying, hey, this is great, yeah, come check it out. And so all around this, is this like spiraling or dancing movement. And but almost this kind of reluctance to really look at what that is. And so again, if we study the mythology of the Buddha and his life and so on, we read so many events, so many things that he's supposed to have done. But that unfathomable mystery of what he actually attained or what he realized on that night under the Bodhi tree. We can only find like words that sort of skirt around, like almost in their mundaneness, almost sometimes, you know, you see that this is the Four Noble Truths, and it's almost like you see these things that are words that are so mundane in a certain sense that they almost defy us to read some kind of deep spiritual truth into them. This is suffering, this is the origin of suffering, this is the ending of suffering, this is the way leading to the ending of suffering. And this becomes this very, very, it's like, so what, you know? What's the big deal, yeah? So in a sense, like almost the mundaneness of it, the everydayness of it, is it itself becomes like another mystery, becomes another thing that hides the profundity of what we're actually looking for. And so this cycle of the smoking by night and flaming by day, this again, this cycle can be understood as part of that spiraling around that empty center. Spiraling around and around and around, and never quite acknowledging what that is. And so it's very easy for us to lose ourselves in these things. It's very easy for us to get caught up in the externals of our holy life as well, to get caught up in, you know, the mundane things of every day, the work that needs to be done, the chores that need to be done. We get caught up in kind of personal interactions with people and getting kind of worried or upset or excited or whatever about, you know, how we can relate to other people. Trying to either, you know, get more of it or get less of it. Move towards it or run away from it. Or we get caught up in kind of activities. So in like a monastery like this, because I sort of emphasize the study of the suttas and so on, and so that can become another kind of displacement activity. We can sort of look at the teachings instead of trying to look at what the teachings are pointing us to, and we can get distracted by that. And it's important to reflect on this and to be honest about these things. In different kinds of places, different kinds of Dhamma tradition, they tend to sometimes point to other kinds of displacement activities and criticize those, but not to notice the ones that they do themselves. So for example, in the forest tradition in Thailand, they will often, you find the monks will be criticizing monks who do study and reading the suttas and say, oh, you should be focusing on the heart of practice and so on and so forth. And of course, there are some monks who do that. But there are very many more monks who are quite happy to criticize others. But, you know, when you see what they're actually doing during the day, then they're spending their time fiddling around with their requisites and, sewing up another kind of bag or pouch to put their toothbrush in or something like that. Or just kind of sitting around discussing some kind of Kruba Ajahn's psychic power adventures and battles with nagas and things like this, or else looking at amulets and so on and so forth. And so there are all kinds of different displacement activities that we can use. So there's nothing too much to be done about this except to recognize it, and recognize that that's what we are doing. We are really trying to distract ourselves from the important thing, and that there's no substitute for it. There's no substitute for actually just looking into your heart and seeing what's there. And this is really, really important. All of that, you know, we have to do it. We have to think. We have to plan. We have to do things. We have to work. We have to have our stuff. That's part of who we are. It's part of human life. It's part of the world. And in a sense, it's good for us, especially as people who want to make a long-term monastic career. We need to have some kind of external interest which is going to help to sustain us and support us. It's good. You know, so we shouldn't be disparaging or putting those things down. There's almost nobody that I know of. In fact, I don't know of anybody who just spends all their day meditating and not doing anything else. It doesn't happen. And there's no reason why it should happen. There's no way the Buddha says that, you know, only meditate and never do anything else. You know, there are periods of time when it's good to do that. But then there are other aspects of our mind which need developing in other ways. So that's okay. We don't need to feel guilty about it. But we need to notice, this is of course the very hard thing, is to notice where that's edging over and tipping over into distraction and displacement and so on. And this is the trick, is to understand this. And so, you know, when it comes down to it, what actually is that smoking at night? And this is something which is very I think very, very beautiful, very almost terrifying. It's like the best kind of beauty is something which is very terrifying. And, you know, to me this is still something I find very, very powerful. It's just that act of being alone and with nobody around, just in the middle of the bush, not in a house, not being somewhere where there's electricity wired up and energy moving around and people coming and going and flushing the toilet and all those things, but being really out in seclusion, in just by yourself. And just at night time, you know, to know that it's just blackness out there and you're just alone. And to look into your heart, not to do any meditation, not to do like a meditation technique where you've got this, that's almost like another crutch. Having a meditation technique is another crutch. It's also a displacement activity. That's like, it's almost hiding, it's reassuring you that you're doing something and not, it's almost, it can be a substitute for actually looking into your mind. instead of really looking and really trying to understand, then you do a meditation technique. And I think this is the reason why, for example, Krishnamurti was very critical of Buddhist meditation in many ways. And he felt that, I guess, that the kinds of meditation he'd been exposed to were quite probably very kind of systematic and object orientated, and were more about doing a technique rather than actually self-discovery or self-awareness. So there's some truth to that. There's also some falsehood to it, because through using a technique it enables us to go deeper into our heart and to explore deeper. I'm not saying that we shouldn't use the techniques, but there's a time to also just to look into the heart. Not be trying to shape that according to some idea. Not be trying to pretend, oh, I'm a Buddhist monk, so I've got to be happy. I've got to be together. I've got to be mindful. I've got to be all of these things. Not to be thinking, oh, I'm so and so. I've got a degree in something. I'm an older person. I've got all this life experience and mature wisdom. You know, I'm a teacher. I'm a young person. I've got all these kind of energy and fresh ideas. Or not to have all of these kinds of conceits or ideas about yourself, but to just look. And just to look, and just to accept with total humility and compassion whatever is there. Not trying to fit it into some doctrine or dogma. Not trying to ask yourself, you know, is this that stage, or is this that, you know, level, or is this that whatever. But just to know what that is. And it's from this kind of depth of awareness. This is where the true insights will arise. Things that will come up, nameless things that will arise in the mind, like creatures arising from the depths. Nameless monsters with squiggly bits. You know, like all the things that you see when they send the submarines down to the bottom of the ocean and they photograph these amazing creatures down there. You never suspected them. They're all there. Enough for this evening, a little talk on the smoking by night and flaming by day. So I offer this to you for your reflection. And I'd like to invite any comments or questions. Because they're pretty horrible, they've got big teeth and these kind of suckers, and they scream. That's another advantage of having kutis out in the forest. And especially caves, you can really let rip. Sometimes it happens, you know, and I think it's quite normal. You get this. This happens to me. You sort of when that happens, and the mind sort of sinks down, and then you just goes into, and you see one of these things happen, and then it just happens. You just scream, or you kind of you have some kind of extreme bodily reaction or something like that. And I've done some great screams in my time, but one of the problems. Okay, there's a few different things, but one of the problems is that when this is often that we tend to overreact when the squealy things come, and we get startled by them. You know, I mean, it's just like, and most of the time it's like that. Most of the time it's like you're sitting reading a book and a cockroach crawls on your leg and you go, "Oh God!" Well, actually, it's only a cockroach. Who cares? And so you're getting overly startled, and this is. That's actually most of the time is like that. You don't. It's just a matter of just being aware of it, and then it's okay. I think in some cases it's probably more than that, and you have to be more careful. And that's where you need some, I guess, some pajanya. Well, that's like something like common sense in your meditation, and it depends on. That's very individual. Depends on your own level of emotional. Development, whether you're able to take it on board or not. Sometimes you just have to say no, shove it back in its hole for now, and I'll just leave the basement and close the door and shut that down, and I'll go up to the and sun myself upstairs for a while, and I'll come down and deal with the basement later on. Yeah, but I think so it needs to be taken with care. Yeah, not pushing too much, and not feeling that you have to. There's a difference between repressing something and then just putting it to one side, you know? You know, you can still be aware that those things are there without having to kind of indulge in them. And, you know, especially if you notice that the thing, those experiences are having an adverse effect on your state of mind, and especially if that's coming out in your speech and body, for example, if you're getting like angry with people and all of these, it's upsetting your emotional equilibrium. It's not unusual that should happen to a small degree, but if that's happening repeatedly or to a large degree, then that's a sign something's wrong. Yeah. I know. So, my third reigns with Sri Panyo and Ajahn Chandiko, and Sri Panyo always used to be able. To, well, he reckoned he could always tell what kind of meditation that Ajahn Chandiko had been doing the night before, because if he'd been doing like metta meditation, he'd come down and be kind of friendly and stuff, and if he'd been doing the Suva meditation, he'd come down and be kind of grumpy and not want to talk to anybody. Well, some kinds of issues are never going to come up in meditation. So you can't solve all of your problems through meditation. You know, because meditation is only part of the Eightfold Path. It's not the whole of the Eightfold Path. So some things just won't come up at all, and so this is where some people can get very much blind spots in some aspects of their practice. But some things will come up, but it will take time. But again, that's like a I think in some ways you have to trust your own intuitive wisdom. That things come up at their own time in their own place. And so as long as you're just being very, very kind of open and very honest with what's going on, things take their own time. Yeah.